amazing. I can't believe how long it's taking us to get into this building. There's so many people here.
Fans and protesters turn out for the Glenn Beck, Sarah Palin event in Anchorage. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 13th of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, as Alaskans soak up the good weather, meteorologists are scratching their heads.
Normally from roughly mid-August through September is our rainy season, and when it's not raining, it's usually pretty cloudy, as most long-term residents know.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering online courses from any location. Information at distance.uaf.edu. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
Congress is returning to Washington, but Senator Lisa Murkowski is not among those hustling back to the nation's capital. She's still in Alaska, and her staff will not speculate on when she will return to D.C. Her Anchorage campaign staff says her schedule is open at this point while she meets with members of the public and with personal friends and her family to make a decision on her political future. Murkowski is deciding whether to launch a write-in re-election campaign after losing the Republican primary last month to challenger Joe Miller of Fairbanks. Her campaign staff says she is still weighing the decision, but there is no firm deadline for announcing it. Republican gubernatorial candidate Bill Walker is also weighing his options to be part of the November general election. Walker got 33% of the Republican vote for his campaign, which focused on promoting the All-Alaska Gas Pipeline from the North Slope to Valdez. His staff says the issue was not adequately covered by other candidates, and Walker believes it needs a higher profile this fall. Like Senator Murkowski, Walker is considering a write-in campaign. His staff says he will decide by the end of the day on Wednesday. Congress is planning a short burst of activity after the long August recess, but as APRN's Libby Casey reports, it won't necessarily be a highly productive one.
Congress is trickling back to Washington. The Senate met Monday afternoon to confirm a circuit court judge, and the House returns Tuesday. Members are scheduled to be here 4 weeks before heading home for election season, but House leaders now say they may shave a week off that and wrap up work October 1st. With all 435 members of the House up for re-election and the balance of power in question, campaigning back home is top priority. In the Senate, one-third of members face voters on November 2nd. It's the Senate that needs to do some heavy lifting in the next couple of weeks if anything of substance is to happen in Washington. Top on its agenda is a small business bill, which would give $12 billion in tax breaks and improve loan and credit access. It would be paid for by spending cuts. Alaska Senator Mark Begich supports it, and Democrats got the one crossover Republican needed to break a filibuster when retiring Ohio Senator George Voinovich said he'd vote for it. But what else will get done in the next month? Expect rhetoric and debate over whether to extend the tax breaks put into place by President George W. Bush. They're slated to expire at the end of the year, but Democrats are likely to push for extensions for middle-class Americans, not, however, for the highest wage earners, those who make over $200,000, or households earning a quarter million. Republicans want those top breaks kept, but many Democrats are resistant, citing the deficit. Whether the tax breaks will actually come to a vote before Election Day is up in the air. Capitol Hill watchers say it's more likely to be a point of political debate rather than immediate action. There are some timely topics, like a food safety bill, which Congress may consider in the wake of this summer's salmonella egg outbreak. But what about climate change and energy? Don't count on it moving forward. Even oil spill legislation will likely wait until after the November election. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
On Saturday, more than 4,000 people turned out in Anchorage to see cable television personality Glenn Beck, along with former Governor Sarah Palin and U.S. Senate candidate Joe Miller. They paid from $73 to $225 apiece, and they had to walk by a number of protesters to get in. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
Whatever it was that attracted people to Glenn Beck's Restoring Honor rally in Washington was also a strong draw in Alaska. They lined up more than an hour ahead of time, and the lines extended down both sides of the Denina Convention Center, looping around the back and on down 8th Avenue in both directions, so there were plenty of people there to see the big black limousine pull into the back. It took quite a while to get people through the gates on a beautiful but cooling fall day. But the crowd's enthusiasm was undiminished.
Oh, I'm so surprised. I mean, this is amazing. I can't believe how long it's taking us to get into this building. There's so many people here.
And those people had to walk past quite a few protesters. Many accusing Beck and Palin of exploiting the 9th anniversary of the terrorist attack of 9/11. Beck has insisted his speaking engagement with Palin had nothing to do with that. Earlier in the day, there had been a protest rally on the Park Strip under the flag at half-staff in memorial to the 9/11 victims. Activist Deesa Jacobson was one of those who called the rally.
Alaskans are gathered here under the same flag to stand openly against the twin juggernauts of hate and fear. Therefore, we will have twin rallies, one on this day and one this night, to bring twin beacons of light to those who choose to live and walk in darkness.
A number of the protesters said their message was directed at Beck and Palin's fans.
What I'm hoping is that with enough people saying enough things about the truth of these narcissists, that over time, those people who have them on such a pedestal will come out of denial and will start understanding that they're being used for profit by these false leaders.
This one says, snap out of it, America.
Some got up early to drive to town from the Kenai Peninsula or the Matanuska or Susitna Valleys. An Anilchik woman said it was the whole Tea Party movement, but especially its U.S. Senate candidate, that worried her.
It's absolutely scary. I grew up in Alaska, and I am scared over Joe Miller.
And a couple of people were there to protest the protesters.
Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin believe what they say. There are people who say Glenn Beck, conservative, and they add a lot of baggage to that, which isn't true.
The only real fireworks was the flash of cameras as the Glenn Beck fans rounded the corner of the building and got a look at the protesters. Many of them were smiling. They were taking pictures as if the protest was just part of the show. While Beck's oratory has taken a religious tone in recent weeks and there are serious political issues at stake, some Alaskans indicated it was a simple matter of celebrity and the desire to be next to it that brought them out.
I actually bought the tickets the day they went on sale.
And what are you expecting tonight?
I really have no idea. Just something to go to in Alaska, I guess.
Well, I've been a follower of Glenn Beck for a while and just enjoy his presentations. I also enjoy his ideology and consequently had the opportunity to see him in person and thought I would take advantage of it.
And inside, past the booths and concessions, the hall awaited. The seats in front sold out, facing a flag and a blackboard. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, looking for new ways to address racism.
How do we take our healing conversations about race and racism in Alaska and turn it into something that actually starts to change and shape policy?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a pre-existing medical condition, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the new temporary federal insurance program being administered by ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. The program is for those with qualifying pre-existing conditions and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months. Talk to an independent insurance broker or go online to ACHIA.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
From Juneau through Anchorage and up to Fairbanks, the weather forecast for the rest of the week better resembles California than Alaska. South Central residents are embracing the sunny skies and warm weather, especially enthusiastically, after suffering through one of the coolest, rainiest summers on record. John Papanow, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Anchorage, has a new report out that takes a look at why summers in South Central are so variable, especially in recent years. It's called The Agony and Ecstasy of South Central Summers. Hi, John.
Good afternoon.
So, first things first, how long is this nice weather going to last?
Yeah, you know, the current model runs that we use to forecast show this ridge of high pressure that we're having centered over the Gulf of Alaska extending up through the state, probably at least through Friday, potentially through the weekend, although I would put a question mark by the weekend. You know, the models that far out can have problems, but looking pretty good for the whole week.
Well, that sounds great. How unusual is it for it to be so sunny and warm in mid-September?
It is quite unusual. You know, normally from roughly mid-August through September is our rainy season, and when it's not raining, it's usually pretty cloudy, as most long-term residents know. I look back at some of the historical data, and interesting enough, one of the early years, 1979, was pretty warm, at least for the first 10 days of September was pretty warm and pretty clear skies. There's been some warmer Septembers since then, like 2005 was pretty warm. 1995 was actually tied for the warmest September in recent decades. However, that was quite cloudy, and so what it did, the cloud cover actually made it warmer at night. So when we go to average the daytimes and the nighttime temperatures, it brought up the monthly temperature and made it quite warm. So just because the war is warm during the month doesn't necessarily mean it's cloud-free and non-rainy.
So by contrast, this glorious weather that we're having right now, why was this summer so terrible?
That is a good question, and I haven't really resolved why it was bad. And we know, you know, from time to time we get some. 2008 was the most recent one, and that was actually cooler. Cloud cover was probably fairly identical, but that was definitely a cooler June, July, and August period. The actual reason why, I really don't know. There's a couple of kind of guesses why it might be. The big picture. When we look at the weather and the storm track during the summer, it can shift different directions. When we have cold ones, it looks like some of the time we get this area of lower pressure, which is persistent over the Bering even during the summer, shifts a little bit further west into the western Alaska, and that brings cold air from the Arctic area down through either through western Alaska into South Central, or it wraps around through the Eastern Bering and then in the Northern Gulf, and then it gets moved, transported back into South Central through the southerly winds that we typically get. So I'm still working on why, you know, we get warm summers and cool summers.
Well, I was reading through your report, The Agony and Ecstasy of South Central Summers, earlier, and it seems like the only consistent thing is the inconsistency. Is there any way to explain the variability of South Central summers when you look back at weather records?
No, that's very difficult. You know, there is some very modest correlation or relationship with things like the water temperature out in the Pacific, although it's not a real strong relationship, so we can't really use that as to forecast. There's other things that may be going on higher up in what we call the stratosphere, which is generally, let's say, about 10 miles and above, which is still part of the atmosphere. There can be different things going on in terms of solar fluxes, and there's a lot of speculation out there in the research community. What's going on in terms of not only just Alaska, but the whole North Pacific area, winter and summer. And people look at things like regime shifts, where we have major pattern changes over periods of decades and that kind of thing. And there's just a lot of uncertainty of what is really going on and what's controlling it. So I think there's multiple factors there.
John Papineau is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Anchorage. A judge is considering additional arguments in the case of a state lawmaker's grandchildren charged with trying to import alcohol into a dry community. The dispute centers around Alaska's local option law and its apparent ambiguous implementation in the village of Angoon. KTOO's Matt Miller reports.
23-year-old Shanara D. Kukesh and 31-year-old Albert M. Kukesh III were each charged with importing liquor last February. A state trooper says he noticed liquor in a vehicle used by the Kukeshes on board the state ferry Lakani as it departed Juneau for Angoon. A search later turned up 12 bottles of whiskey, additional bottles of rum, schnapps, vodka, and 30 cans of beer. Defense attorneys say it's the first ever attempted prosecution for importation in Angoon, and it cannot be done. Under Alaska's local option law, Angoon citizens voted to ban possession in 1988, but not specifically sale or importation. Angoon residents and even lawyers and state troopers have apparently believed that importation was still allowed. Defense attorney Julie Willoughby says the lack of notice and fairness makes it a due process violation.
I understand that somebody, if the court finds that it is in fact a crime, that somebody has to be the first person that's prosecuted. But I would argue to the court that prior to that prosecution, that the people of Angoon need to be made aware that it is in fact a crime. Now, generally speaking, I understand that ignorance of the law is no excuse, but where an entire community has been confused and in fact their own state troopers have told them that it's not a crime, I think that the government, the state, owes the people of Angoon something more and needs to tell them what, in fact, is proscribed by statute.
Prosecutors contend that alcohol prohibition in Angoon included criminalization of importation when state law was revised in 1995. District Attorney Doug Gardner also argues that since Angoon voters recently have been reluctant to relax the alcohol ban, then importation is still prohibited.
The city of Angoon and the assembly were careful. They didn't want to lose their dry status. As the petitions were proposed over the years, it seems to the state, those petitions always started with the proposition that the community's dry, that subsection A5 applies, and that anything, whether it was creating a city-run liquor store, whether it was just banning importation and sale, allowing something short of a full ban, it seems that all of the propositions started with the idea that possession, importation, and sale were what the state of the law was.
Subsection A5 that Gardner refers to is a portion of state law specifying that a possession ban also includes a ban on importation and sales. Shannara Kukesh is being charged with a felony and Albert Kukesh a misdemeanor, according to the amount of liquor they allegedly purchased. A jury trial planned for earlier this month was replaced by oral arguments and an evidentiary hearing on additional documentation presented by Gardner. No definitive date for a ruling on that evidence or a previous request by the defense for the charge's dismissal. Trial is now rescheduled for next January. The Kukeshes are grandchildren of State Senator Albert Kukesh, who's advocated for limiting alcohol in villages. Their case is being heard by Sitka Superior Court Judge David George, the same judge who dismissed most of prosecutors' case against the elder Kukesh and three others for subsistence fishing violations recently. Judge George presided over that case because Angoon's magistrate is Senator Kukesh's daughter. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
The Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance has a simple request. If you smoke, take it outside. Smoking hurts more than just you. Secondhand smoke increases the risk of coronary heart disease and kills nearly 50,000 non-smoking Americans every year. Smoking around your kids causes chronic and life-threatening diseases and is linked to sudden infant death syndrome. If you choose to smoke, make a choice that protects others who don't. Take it outside. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
The challenger in the Republican primary race for State House District 2 has conceded the race. Just 142 votes separate challenger Stephen Samuelson of Petersburg and five-term incumbent Representative Peggy Wilson of Wrangell for the Republican nomination to represent Wrangell, Petersburg, Sitka, Pelican, Elfin Cove, and Port Alexander in the State House. KFSK's Joe Vicnicki reports.
Steven Samuelson, the 33-year-old hardware store employee, says he's encouraged that he made gains in his second attempt to defeat Wilson.
You know, I'm not totally disappointed of not winning. Everybody that gets into this has to understand that running against a 10-year incumbent is a very hard thing to do. But there's a lot of things that I'm very proud of.
Samuelson won 47% of the Republican ballots cast to Wilson's 53%. That compares to the 61-39 split in the first contest between the two in 2008. Samuelson says he's likely to run for the seat again in 2 years. For now, he says he wants a member of the majority party in the state house to win the seat this year.
It's important to have a Republican in there at this time, just strictly because it's somebody that can work easily with the governor and Bert Stedman, Senator Stedman, and hopefully get more for the district.
The unofficial results have Wilson with 1,230 votes to Samuelson's 1,088. The 65-year-old registered nurse and incumbent says she's pleased with the outcome.
It was a close race. I knew it would be, and so I'm just pleased that it turned out the way it did.
Wilson says she did not start campaigning until May following the legislative session, and Samuelson had a head start on the campaign trail. He also raised more money and outspent Wilson. He reported just over $23,000 in income in a 7-day report leading up to the August primary, and Samuelson reported spending just under $18,000. Meanwhile, Wilson reported income of over $13,000 and spent nearly $5,000 during that time. Wilson says she's getting ready for the general election.
I'm excited to go on because there's some things that I want to work on and continue working on that I have worked on before. And it's an ongoing process always. And I'm looking forward to it and actually have started making plans for the November election now.
Wilson has a challenge from Democratic candidate Reber Stein of Sitka in November. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Wicknicki.
Reber Stein is a member of Sitka's assembly. He says he would have preferred to be running against Samuelson.
I was looking forward to working with Stephen and discussing the issues affecting Southeast and the challenges ahead. My concern running against Peggy is that we'll be debating her record, and I don't think that helps us craft a future for Southeast Alaska.
Stein wants to push for more land available for building. He also says he'll advocate for an increase in the local share of the state fish tax. He'll also focus on the region's high cost of living.
My campaign is focused on the affordability and livability of life here in the district. Our communities all are facing challenges that I think better representation can meet. And one of the issues, at least here in Sitka, is working hard to ensure that we get adequate state support for our electricity projects. If we don't get the support that we need, we can expect our rates to go up by at least 20%.
Stein and Wilson are running to represent Sitka, Wrangell, Petersburg, Elfin Cove, Kuprinoff, Pelican, and Port Alexander in the State House. The general election is November 2nd. Judging by some recent Anchorage incidents, racism is a problem in the city. Some young people videotaped themselves harassing an Alaska Native man. Radio show hosts shared vulgar, tasteless jokes about Alaska Natives, and a Samoan couple was not allowed into a local restaurant. An anti-racism activist and author and a local Alaska Native leader were guests on Anchorage radio station KMBA today. Reporter Jacqueline Estes has more.
A 2001 study by the Institute of Social and Economic Research at the University of Alaska Anchorage showed blacks, Hispanics, and Asians complained of subtle discrimination, such as bad service in restaurants and shops, belittling comments, and people who acted afraid, suspicious, or disrespectful. Speaker, author, and teacher Tim Weiss says those are symptoms of a false belief system.
As an ideology, it's the belief that certain groups of people defined as separate races are superior or inferior to other groups of people defined as races, that they have certain traits or characteristics or abilities which make them fundamentally better or worse than others.
That ideology, says Weiss, has consequences far beyond poor restaurant service. Governmental reports show significant disparities between whites and people of color, including shorter life expectancy.
Racism is about white supremacy, white domination, and the subordination of peoples of color. Sometimes it's very overt, sometimes it's more subtle. But the way that it plays out in a place like Alaska, it's still about, you know, land distribution inequities. It's still about health disparities. It's still about educational disparities. It's still about criminal justice system disparities. It's about the way that certain folks of color, defined as something other than white in this culture, continue to find themselves, and not by accident, at the bottom of the economic, social, and political barrier.
Weiss says another aspect to racism is that people of color monitor attitudes toward them, as the changing views of whites can have serious consequences. However, he says whites don't worry, for instance, that the Unabomber's 20 years of mail bombings and the hundreds of bombings of parenting clinics by whites will lead to racial profiling of them. But he says the 9/11 destruction by 19 men has led to stereotyping of more than a billion people of the Islamic faith around the world. Weiss finds the uproar over a community center near the Twin Tower site ironic.
And I think what's fascinating is how we ignore a parallel situation. Just about every square foot of land in what we now call the United States was ground zero for someone who was Native. But we don't say we're not going to build churches on that land because Christian churches were used to rationalize the slaughter and the conquest of indigenous peoples. And if I were to say that we ought to do that, folks would say, well, now that's crazy.
Liz Medicine Crow is the Policy Center Director at the First Alaskans Institute. She says people also often don't understand one very important fact about the relationship of Alaskan Natives and Native Americans with the United States government.
Our primary relationship is a political one and has nothing to do with race. And it gets its foundation in our sovereignty that predated the Constitution and is reflected in the U.S. Constitution.
In addition to educating people about Alaskan Native history and cultures and promoting coverage of positive actions and individuals, Medicine Crow says Alaskan Natives now have to discuss and decide their next steps.
What are we prepared to do about it? And how do we take our healing conversations about race and racism in Alaska and turn it into something that actually starts to change and shape policy so that we do affect the institutions and help to make institutional racism unstable here in Alaska?
Tuesday, Tim Weiss will be a guest on the Alaska Public Radio Network's Talk of Alaska at 10 in the morning, and he will speak at the UAA Wendy Williamson Auditorium at 7:30 that evening. In Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. You can follow us on Twitter at aprn. We had reports tonight from Matt Miller in Juneau, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Het Schoenfeld in Sitka, and Jocelyn Estes in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. And by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.